Well, this part of the podcast, we actually wanted to move more to Extraction, because I know that was like a really big movie that you had a big role in. What was the creative process actually like? Obviously with Sam directing, but especially for that one that whole one take that you guys had.
Extraction was a wild ride. That was my first outing as a solo fight coordinator on like a big film. And the when I first got approached, Dan Stevens is the coordinator on that. I'd worked with him in Logan. He doubled Hugh Jackman for that film, and really, really great guy. We'd worked together a few times. He asked me if I wanted to fight coordinate for it, if I'd be down. I came in. My assumption was that I was like probably ninth or tenth on the list. I was like, there's no way that you're picking me for this thing. But and I you know I we after talking with Sam like over the phone, for the first time, and meeting with these guys, it was like you sort of get like an idea for their vision, and like having read the script, I was like, oh, there's not really that much fighting in it, it seems like. I was completely wrong. There's a ton of fighting, obviously. Like, and Sam
It's
put it
all
right, was
accurate.
like, well, yeah, but yeah, he's all like, gunfights are fights. And I was like, oh, you're right. I guess I'm going to previs every gunfight too, or as much as I can. And, because the thing with like, I guess shooting a gunfight is nowadays, especially post John Wick era, like, or in the middle of it, you can think about gunfights from back in the day where it was just Rambo stands up and he shoots a gun. You cut to inserts of guys getting hit and flying and, getting exploded and stuff like that. Nowadays, the guns are almost inextricably like linked to fight stuff. It's like, at what point does he, if this guy grabs the gun and we fire it, he has to re-rack the gun, clear the malfunction, and then he can keep on shooting it. That's part of fight choreography too. So it's just having a lot more things to think about, nowadays. You're trying to meet the level of all these things that have come before. For something like Extraction, reading the script, like talking with the directors, or with the director and the stunt team, it was like I kind of formed an idea of how I wanted his style to be, in terms of it's, it's a lot of it is just a blitzkrieg effect, I was like, it's a shock and awe campaign. He doesn't have time to stand around and like, combat these guys, when his real mission is to get the kid out of here. So sometimes the best, solution is just to blast through and then, yeah, hope they don't catch up to you. Hopefully you're like out the, hopefully you've robbed the bank and you're out the door before the phone calls even go out. Not that I'm advocating crime, but the with something like Extraction, we also had a really great fight team. So those guys were down to throw a lot of crazy concepts. And I kind of just pushed the barrier, like they wanted high energy. So at one point, I literally said, all right, let's feed in these concepts and we'll just go so insane that the only thing they can do is dial us back. And a lot of that stuff ended up in
That's a
the
good
big
idea.
oneer. Yeah, it's like they can always tell us to go less, but it's really hard for them to, it sucks if they have to tell us to go more, which they actually did at one point in time. They were like a little underwhelmed with me at the first concepts that I put out there because, I'll admit it, I was not focusing on the right aspect of the energy, and that again, that's part of fulfilling the director's vision that, fight coordinators for anyone listening out there, it's very important that you focus on getting the director's vision to come across the right way. But yeah, like I sort of like had a whiff on the first pass, and then the second week I was like, let's just go the other direction, go so hardcore insane that there's no way they're gonna like it. They have to pull us back from it. But we'll go in the other direction just so that we can at least sort of be met in the middle. And then lo and behold, Sam was all like, yeah, that's much better. Keep doing that. I was like, oh, okay. So I guess we're just gonna go for the crazy thing. And then of course during production, he did keep toning us back a bit. He made sure it was controlled and not just madness. But yeah, there was some wild stuff in there that I'm really surprised that he let us get away with. I know that in Sam is a very accomplished like martial artist and well versed in like just about every form of combat you can think of. Like we like to joke that like he's the real Tyler Rake, sort of the same way that like we always joke that like the real John Wick is Chad Stahelski. It's like that's like
Yeah.
I think it's just a biopic at this point in time. I don't know, but yes, yeah, Sam was he. He knows so much about fight choreography and coordinating and stunt coordinating that, when he gives you a suggestion, you just listen to him. And if he's telling you to just go swing for the fences, you try your best to be open and creative and do it. And he let me put a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu in there, which was super cool because most movies would not let you get away with it. Like the amount of time that Rake spends just like grappling guys, it could very easily be boring. But it was shot and captured in a way that was very exciting. Hemsworth is an amazing athlete and performer, as well as an actor. He's just phenomenal. So, he made a lot of that stuff very easy to put forth into the movie. And yeah, during like the oneer actually, sorry, I'm kind of off on a tangent, but during the first week that we were there, we were immediately starting to work on the Warner because we knew that was the first sequence we were going to tackle, was like the big nonstop thing, which for me, when they told me that was going to be in there, that we were going to plan like a plus 10 minute Warner involving, you know, like car chases and fights, you know, I'd seen Atomic Blonde and stuff already at this point. So I was like, are we going to try to up that? Like, that's phenomenal. You know, and for me as a stunt man, like going back to, you know, the roots of being a stunt man, my whole impression of that was like, this is going to be something that lives kind of in stunt legacy. You know, if I'm going to be part of something that lives on to the next generation, I think this is one of those things that you're going to look to in like 10 years and be like, man, that scene in Extraction was crazy. You know, it was like the stunt team, you know, that was an amazing thing they did. The same way that like nowadays we'll look back on something like the hospital scene in Hard Boiled, and we'll be like, that is legitimately part of legacy. Filmmaking and stunt legacy exists in that.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like I don't know that anyone will ever top it. Like that's something that those guys should forever feel proud about, you know? And that's something that all of us should forever like look up to and hold as like a piece of action cinematography, you know, as like, that's still one of my favorite movies to this day, like in terms of what I draw inspiration from. And like, I wanted to be part of something that had that same vibe to it, that, you know, it was going to inspire people in the next generation. You know, that's what really excited me about it. The challenge, of course, of doing a Warner is that you're trying to make sure that the stitches all work, that it, you know, it looks like it can be a one take, and that you throw enough red herrings in there where like you think it might be a cut, but it sort of isn't. And then you're like, wait, was that a cut or was that not a cut? Like they could have cut there, but they didn't cut there. You know, that throws people a little off the trail, even when you do know how it was done. I think people, when that car does a reverse 180 in the alley and then the camera shoots into the back seat and they just keep going, a lot of people are like, I don't even understand how that's possible. You know, and it's like, it's crazy. I'd seen shots like that from other things too. Like, I think The Revenant actually had some great stuff in the opening sequence where it looks like the camera just picks up and goes along on a horse. It looks like it accelerates from literally 0 to like 20 miles an hour in the blink of an eye. And like, how, my girlfriend and I were in the theater watching it, and we both turned to each other and were like, how did they do that? And she's not like a filmmaker. She's just a normal, you know, like person who was like, what? That's like hard, right? What they just did, that doesn't seem like it should be normal. I was like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know how they did that. That's incredible. You know, that's so cool. Things like that. They really push the barrier on like, you know, what you can experience like an audience member in the theater. And I think if, you know, at this point in time, when audiences, again, like we said before, like they sort of know how movies are getting made and they kind of have an eye for the behind the scenes, if you can still surprise them and do something like that, like a little bit of cinematic sleight of hand, I think that's really special. I think that's the fact that we were trying to do it even was like a testament to, you know, the vision of it. Cause in the script, it's not, if I remember correctly, it's not written as a Warner. It's just written as like this action scene that happens. And I think Sam's vision, you know, I could be wrong about this, but I feel like his entire vision was to bring it into the realm of the Warner, to take us on like a very intimate journey through this crazy action scene. And, you know, it was gnarly. Like everything in there was very, very tricky and kind of hard to pull off. But in the end, like seeing the results, I'm very proud of like the fact that, you know, you have an actor really doing a lot of complicated stuff, and like all these stunt guys are really selling out, and it pulls itself off like almost as well as, you know, I expected to, you know, better than I expected, actually. You know, it's just sort of a mass undertaking that, you know, you're always scared how that's going to turn out in the end. I'm like, that could end up being horrible, but it ended up being amazing, and everyone talks about it now, and I'm very proud of just having even been a small part of it.
It was pretty amazing. Definitely everyone I know is talking about it. And I was also wondering, in that Warner, you really get a sense of that close quarters aspect of it, especially once they go into the apartment building after the car chase. I was wondering how that claustrophobic or crowded setting of just that city in general really influenced all the fight choreography.
Yeah, like we knew early on that we were going to be shooting there at the location. We kept calling it the mall, strangely. I don't know why. It was just, everyone said it. I was like, why? And they were like, I don't know. It's like, okay, I guess I don't know either. It's just what we call it. It's what we call it. Yeah. I have no idea where it came from. But yeah, area, especially where the gunfights all start kicking off, when they're kind of all the police are combing through the building. There were real world. That's a real. I believe it's a real location. Like, and it, you know, as far as like it, people were living in that apartment, you know, that were letting us shoot there. And there were actual weight restrictions on some of the walkways. You know, like where, look, this is, you know, this building is not it's really big, and there's a lot of like cavernous parts of it and stuff. So it's not reinforced to hold like a crew of 10 or 12 people, you know, if you guys all step in the same spot. So you have to be like really, really careful and ginger about where you're going. And in that way, you sort of know, like, well, we can't really have him fight like six guys here. So like, all right, we'll have him shoot two guys far down the alley and then like two guys attack him up close. And that way no one's ever really in the direct line of like this weight distribution problem that we have. You know, and that was like an actual consideration we had to take into effect for the choreography, as well as the fact that it was a oneer, you know, things like that. And it's wild because like what's cool in a scene like that is you have all these guns, but obviously, you know, a gun is like, it's meant to just punch someone from really far away with a really strong little hand. And it's like, if you're in that situation, like that we had in that building, then it gives you ample opportunity to have, you know, oh, I'm going to grab hold of this gun. Okay. Now we're in sort of this like CQC sort of like element. And, you know, I looked back at stuff like, you know, Metal Gear Solid 4 and 3, and things like that. And you're just saying like, well, what are some cool moments that they did? Because I remember the emotion of that feeling sort of right. It felt like you were trying to sneak around. Someone came up close to you. And if you ever got to the point where you're doing hand-to-hand on somebody, it was still with a gun always involved. So I want to see what that's like, you know. And then, you know, when we're doing it in that area, a lot of those opportunities just sort of presented themselves. It makes sense. You're coming around this corner of course someone's going to be like right there when you buy the corner. You know, it's not, you can only do so much like shooting guys from a distance when you're in such tight cramped spaces. And you know, that sort of becomes an adventure in terms of choreograph around your setting, but still adhere to these kinds of, you know, these characteristics of like the shape of the fight and, you know, the energy of it and what have you. I mean, I'm hoping that it ended up turning out okay. I thought the fights turned out pretty nice. You know, I'm proud of our guys and everything they did. I know some people probably have their qualms with like how the fights turned out, but you know, you're always going to have those limitations on the day. And, you know, you just have to overcome them. I think a lot of fight coordinators in general, like, aren't necessarily expecting that at the beginning of like, I know that you want to do this fight sequence. Here's the things that you cannot do because of these weird reasons. It's like, oh, I can't have four people standing in the same spot at the same time. That's different. You know, that's like, you never really expect to hear that as a limitation on your fight choreography. And then all of a sudden it's there. What are you going to do? You know, you got to make it work.
I think it turned out fantastic. I also think a tiny hand punching someone from really far away is probably the best description of a gun that I've ever heard.
That's what I tell people, like self-defense, you know. I'm always all like, you know, we always think about self-defense as being like a hand-to-hand thing. It's like, you know, that a gun is like, it's basically like someone punching you from like a different like room or a different building sometimes. And they're really strong. I don't know if you guys have ever like punched that hard before. I don't think a punch is ever as hard as a bullet. So,
so I saw, sort of to your point about being in close quarters, Tyler using his rifle to block blows and to strike, or striking with the muzzle of a handgun or something like that. Was there a lot of inspiration from fighting styles like Krav Maga or like Kaisi fighting methods, stuff like that?
Yeah, I think it's so funny because like I think a lot of people have been trying to pinpoint what is his fighting style. It's like a question I get asked a lot. And honestly, I feel like it's just an amalgamation of a lot of self-defense like sort of principles. You know, and then again, there's a lot of wiggle room in there because I don't think everyone believes the same thing about that. You know, like what is right, what is wrong. And that's, you know, ultimately it's like, well, it's also a fictional universe. I think I know a lot of Krav Maga people, you know, have come out with that one. You know, my roommate's actually a Krav Maga instructor. He's like a second degree. And then like I have a buddy who runs his own school out in North Carolina, and he's a Krav Maga guy. And I think they were like, yeah, it's definitely, you can sort of see some influences in there, but it wouldn't be surprising if it wasn't directly influenced by Krav Maga. Because, you know, something like Krav Maga is a martial art that's built off of the backs of other martial arts, I believe, you know, and it's, it has a lot of principles and a lot of methodology, I think, that are somewhat unique to it. But also I've seen a lot of that stuff from like even no holds barred schools back in the day. You know, it's essentially like my very first school that I ever trained at out in Ohio. They said they were a Taekwondo school. And at some point we were throwing like arm bars from the mount and doing neon belly grounded pound. I was like, are you sure this is Taekwondo? I don't remember doing all of these Kali angles and like doing like a Sinawali drill in Taekwondo. But, you know, my background is just a whole lot of, it's like a mishmash of a whole bunch of different things. Something like in Extraction, which I think you're referring to like the first fight scene in the apartment where he's using his rifle to like kind of knock other rifles out of the way before he gets back online and shoots. A lot of that is just in the moment, what feels sort of like I almost looked at it as like, you know, as an actor, what's his objective? You know, what's his end goal in there when he comes in? And it's like essentially to get to the kid, you know? So it's, again, a shock and awe campaign where he flies into it and just starts blasting, and you're going to get caught along the way with surprises. And then it's just, how do you improvise a surprise in that moment? Well, I would never release my finger from like the fire control, you know, on the rifle, you know, it's like, and I have this thing that's like a very big weapon that, you know, it can be used to like kind of parry stuff, you know? And then, you know, I just thought about movies where that's happened before, and I was like, yeah, it's probably fine. You know, I don't think that was anything specific on my end. It's just a lot of, what sort of feels like it would make sense in that moment without violating some of the main principles, I think, of how to do like sort of the more tactical sense of it. The cool thing about Tyler Rake is that he's not like a currently enlisted special forces guy or anything like that. You know, he's a guy that in the beginning of the movie, you see him, he's like, you know, he's got kind of a weird death wish thing. He's like drinking a beer and like jumping off of a cliff. He's kind of a loose cannon, right? So when he's in a fight scene like that, if he does things that are a little unconventional, then that's great, because, you know, then we can make him do some technical stuff and then watch when he gets put in desperate circumstances what sort of less technical stuff he'll do. And something like just, you know, smacking that gun out of the way to get a shot, it just feels very intuitive, you know, and at the same time, it doesn't violate the principles of like, hey, don't take your finger off the trigger. You know what I mean? It's, a lot of that opening fight was sort of a setup for the rest of his style and how it kind of goes. Because what we do is we take a lot of his tools away further and further. He starts with a rifle, then the rifle like doesn't have any ammo, and then it's like you're fighting with like just whatever you can find in the room. He's improvising things, and a lot of that is Tyler Rake. He's very scrappy in that sense, you know. So he can always enter with a plan, but in a shock and awe campaign, you can only get so far before you're like, all right, now we have to sort of figure out the rest of this. That covered the first 30% of that fight scene. The rest of it, he's got to figure out how to get out of that without, you know, without being toasted.
Right. It kind of like matches with his character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those moves.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think that's a big point of it. You know, like, I think most fight corners, I was talking to someone about this the other day, everyone believes in like character and story and like those kinds of things as being a driving source for your choreography. And then when push comes to shove, it's sometimes hard to like really develop a set of principles that guide you. You know, it's like, how well do we understand that character? How well do we understand the story? Because those things also are in flux. You know, Tyler Rake at the beginning of the movie is not the same person he is at the end of the movie. You know, and then so his hero's journey has to also be reflected to a degree, like in the fight choreography, you know, and like how he handles certain things. I don't know that it necessarily shows off a lot in this movie, but I have seen other movies where that's done to great effect. And, you know, that's always an important aspect of me, you know, or that I believe, if, especially in fight choreography, like, you know, you have to be able to exploit and like use as a storytelling device. I think I point this example out a lot to my friends, and I'll just say it here too, but like in the movie, one of the few times I've like cried from fight choreography was in the movie Hero with Jet Li.
Oh yes. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think they make a very concerted choice to like make him this guy who can do all this fight stuff. But at the end, like the fact that he actually have done this deck in a few fight movies, actually they do in Fearless too. I think, but Fearless is another example of it. But like that his last strike is one where he pulls the punch is such an amazing moment. Hero does that. Fearless actually does it really well, because that's the point where he at the beginning is sort of like shown to be this reckless, violent guy. And his father who passed away sort of passes, I believe him, remembering the movie correctly, passes on the idea of like, you know, this isn't about violence. It's about being able to control yourself. And even at this moment when he's like poisoned and, you know, has the chance to take this guy's life and prove the biggest proof that he can show of his skills as a martial artist is the fact that he sort of undoes his punch. Like he kind of like doesn't wind it all the way. It's in that moment of like showing I could have taken his life, but the point is, you know, like look at how I don't, you know, look at the exact inversion of what you'd expect. And it's such a great moment. You know, he does that in a lot of his films, I think about it, but yeah, like those are the kinds of things where you're seeing a character being developed over time. And then it's reflected in the fight choreography is pretty masterful. I think that's an amazing thing. You know, Neo in the third Matrix, he fights blind, like he fights in the real world and gets blinded in it. That fight scene to me was a good example of like, look, Yen Wuping can do all the cool, the dojo fight from the first one, the burly brawl in the second one. He can do these big martial arts extravagant things. Look at the way he choreographs Neo when he's no longer in the Matrix, when he's just a man fighting on the ship in this dark space, blind with another man. it's a very different fight. You know? And I think that's such really, really smart, because a lot of fight choreographers, I think, can be tempted to do something. But what's cool in this moment? It's like, yeah, what serves our story the best way? What serves the vision of the story the best way? You know, that's a clean example of that. And I think in Extraction, I was sort of always trying to make sure we didn't violate it too much. And at the same time, you know, you got to make it cool. You know, it's got to be fun. It's got to be exciting, because you're asking people to hang on to this in the middle of a movie where there's going to be crazy car chases and jumping over buildings and lots of explosions. And the fight action has to hold up to that as well. You know, it can't just be emotion. It has to be emotion fueled by this very visceral sort of nature, you know?
Yeah. And going right off that, about sort of informing your action with character and relationships later on in the film, when Tyler Rake is fighting Gasper, David Harbour's character, or this figure that he had a past with, how does the fact that they have a relationship affect the way you're choreographing that fight?
Yeah, definitely. We had like two big passes of that fight, and a few minor ones. A lot of that also was based on, like, do we know if, like, David Harbour, for example, is down to do all that action? You know, like, how much can we get away with too? We knew Hemsworth was like a badass who could pretty much do whatever, you know, we threw at him as far as action. Like, I never worked with David Harbour before, so I didn't know. And when they told me, it was like, oh no, he's the new Hellboy. I was like, oh, okay, we're probably fine. You know, we'll just like, we'll make sure that we don't make it like obnoxiously complicated or anything like that. And, you know, I would say that my first previs is still somewhat complicated. It was a ton of jujitsu is what it was. And I just thought of, like, you know, essentially two guys who had been sort of out of the game for a while. You know, Tyler Rake is injured at that point in time, and they've both been drinking, and Gaspar is, you know, not necessarily in the field as, you know, like the same way all the time. And so he's kind of retired. And then putting those two together in a fight where, you know, I just thought about it. It was like, you know, it's almost like when you're fighting like a brother, you know what I mean? And they essentially should fight somewhat similarly. They kind of have like the same vibe as far as skill set. You know, it's like, what do you do when you know what the other person's going to do? You know, it kind of becomes a war of attrition. Who is willing to be the most brutal person in that moment? You know, and I feel like in that fight, we choreographed to the point where, like, both of them sort of hold back a little bit. There's a lot of points at which someone can break off and say, are you done yet? Are you done yet? I don't want to fight you. Or can you please stop? Because that's how the fight starts. You know, it's like, you know, did you call somebody? Who did you call? And he's all like, just let me go. Trust me, I'm trying to help you out by killing the kid, whatever. They're in this standstill of like, I don't want to do this. You know, can you please let me just take care of you, so that way we don't have to become violent? And then it escalates, you know, it's just competing principles, you know. And then when they start going after it, there's a lot of parts in there where it's, you know, it's when you're fighting someone that you know, and it's like you're just holding them down for half of it, and it's like, I could just pummel you, mm-hmm. you know. And there's a lot of that, and I think that's like expanding upon that idea to a point where they're also both very technical, they're both very skilled. Yeah, it just sort of becomes are we really doing this? Like, how far are we stepping to the point where we're going to have to take it all the way in, you know? And I think that culminates in that moment when Gaspar is like, hey man, like, what are we doing here? And like, just stay down. Like, I'm giving you essentially the last warning. And, you know, Tyler Rake doesn't, and it gets him thrown through a table for it. And then at that point, it's like, all right, all bets are off. I'm going to punch you now, and then I'm going to stab you. Like, I'm sorry. You made the choice to put yourself in this position. Is kind of the vibe that it has, which, you know, if you're fighting someone that you've known for a long time, even if it's someone that you didn't like the whole time, like, I feel like a rivalry, even with someone that I didn't like, I wouldn't want to kill them. I'd want to prove that I'm better, but, you know, and dominate them, but I wouldn't want to mm-hmm. kill them. Mm-hmm. So to cross that threshold is a pretty, pretty far point, you know, if it's someone that you're familiar with. Yeah. In that fight, there's a lot of desperation and stuff in it too. Neither one of them are at kind of full capacity or full strength. You know, they're both drunk. And so I think he smacks him with like a tea kettle or something at one point in time. You know, it's like, and like, I think Gaspar punches him in his arm that's been shot. It's just a lot of like sort of mean stuff, you know, it's like punching someone in the neck, slapping him in the ear. It's like, it's like, I didn't grab a kitchen knife and shank him to death, but yeah. I did want to sort of like beat the crap out of him until he couldn't fight me anymore. And then I assume we were going to stop fighting, right? And it's like, oh, well.
It's the same.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of that vibe was sort of always there in the beginning of the fight, where they just keep going at it until they're so tired that it's like, you know, the only option is, all right, I guess now I have to kill you. And then the kid shows up. I'm sorry if I'm spoiling this for anyone who hasn't seen the movie. I don't know why you would be listening to this. haven't watched it. But yeah, it came out back in April. Like, everyone should have seen it by now, right? But yeah, that idea of whittling it down to the point where there's no option left but to kill somebody is, you know, that's a tough journey to go on. In the script, it's written as like I believe in the original draft anyhow, it was like Gaspar Rake punches him once or something. Gaspar pulls the gun immediately from like his waistband or something like that, and then the kid shoots him in the back or whatever. To say it's written as very, very short, and there's not like a huge fight there. But then, you know, it's like, why wouldn't they have a huge fight? Of course there's a big fight scene. You know, this is going to be like something where they, you know, it's two guys who, this is the first time Rake's really fighting someone besides Saju, the character Saju, where it's him face to face with someone who knows how to actually fight, you know, like the same way that he does. Yeah. So it ended up becoming like a really cool thing. And to, you know, I'll say this right now, like I said earlier, like we didn't know how David Harbour was going to do. He was outstanding. Like I was teaching him some really complicated jiu-jitsu stuff, even on the day. And he'd be like, well, can't I just do this? Like, wouldn't I just do this? And I was like, well, if you do that, like, and it'd be something technical, like when you bump your hips, keep them up so that way you can hip escape. Otherwise, you know, the friction of the floor keeps holding you down. And it was just something like convoluted like that. But he was like, oh, okay. Like he immediately got it. It was like, oh, okay, cool. And then he would just do it. And so like that fight scene is almost entire, like so much of that is actually wow. David Harbour and Chris Hemsworth fighting each other, that it's just outstanding. Like they did have doubles. We did do a pass with doubles for it. You know, they should get a lot of credit for it as well. But, you know, I think David Harbour did way more than I was expecting to do. And had such an easy time with it. I was like, how do we have two actors in this fight scene who just get it? And they're so good and capable and are chill. Like they were so, you know, chill about it and polite. So yeah, it was gnarly. You dream that you get that. So.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I remember seeing the film. I was like, can David Harbour fight? I was like, you know, I didn't know the ability that he had.
Pardon? Yeah. Oh, he was outstanding. And just mentally, just super, super nice and smiling and stuff while we were shooting it too. It's, you know, I don't know if he understood, because again, I don't know if the script had ever tipped him off that there was going to be a big fight there. But yeah, for just having that sort of thrown at him, you know, like in such a big way, because that's also, even in a movie where like that fight would totally happen in the script, I don't know that anyone would expect that fight would be that involved and have that much to do. And man, they pull it off beautifully. I think it's a really fun fight.
Yeah, it's definitely involved. I see stuff when I'm watching it. You see Tyler Rake shifting ground positions, going from mount to neon belly. You're seeing a judo throw through a table. A really nice clinch sweep where you have Chris Hemsworth like collecting David Harbour's leg and then shoving him over. It definitely reminded
me. Yeah, a little Kosato Gari, I want to say. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
It reminded me a bit of a cage fight. And I was wondering if that was a conscious thought in your head when you were going through the choreo for this, or if you were just building up this fight scene and at the end it sort of just happened to resemble a more skilled match between two fighters in a cage.
Yeah, like so and this is a little weird personal thing. So like I'm a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've trained under the last I guess it's almost about 9 years now, under a guy named James Gavsey. Runs a place called Max Impact Martial Arts out here in the Pacific Palisades. And obviously they're not doing anything right now, really, just like online Zoom classes. But he sort of changed my entire idea about ground fighting and really revolutionized a lot. And one of the things that he always said was like, the kind of martial arts that we do, if you're really going to study Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you're probably not going to be out there like stopping bank robbers with it. You know, a lot of the times what we practice is, and if you're in a cage fight, that's a whole different thing. The stuff that we do is honestly a lot of like, it's a lot of just pinning and holding down, because he's like, you know, I think he refers to it as like the drunk brother-in-law or like the drunk uncle, you know, like someone at a party that you're like, he's my friend. Yeah. I don't want to hurt him, but I got to stop him from he's starting to get really belligerent. He's like, you know, starting a fight, like I got to hold him down. And just how do you do that? Like, how do you stop somebody from, you know, causing more damage themselves? It's like, well, you could just punch him in the face a bunch of times and like knock him out. It's like, I'm pretty sure that's going to end horribly. You know, it's like escalates too quickly. And so like, there's a lot of this, kind of thing, like, oh, you got to tie him up. Like, okay, this is how I'm going to get him to the ground. This is how I'm going to like hold him down, like pin him and stuff, and keep him from doing anything until eventually he'll gas himself out, and then we can talk. You know, we can talk about it once he's tired and I agree to let him up. You know, and it's like that big brother moment, right? with something like Extraction, yeah, like you definitely do see like the way that we use the environment a lot, like the stair railing and things, like getting to the floor, how cramped it is. If it feels like a cage fight, I honestly think it's because there's so much jujitsu in there and ground and pound stuff, which I did want to bring that to life. Like the idea of, you know, this is how you could potentially get out of stuff. I even remember David Harbour at one point was like, you know, I gave him a note, and it's just because, you know, he's not like a 10th planet jujitsu guy or something weird, you know, like he has some bizarre competition background. You know, he's like a Broadway actor, you know, he's a fantastic one who's, you know, it's my job to make sure that he looks good doing jujitsu, you know, not. But it's like he was doing something. I think it's like literally before Rake goes to that, he kind of does like a little helicopter pass over into from the mount into the side control, then to the neon belly. And I was telling, like, you know, the reason why he has to do that is because you're going to start to escape. You know, like I was like telling David. So like, I know you it's instinct to want to put your hands up to just like try and stop the punches, but put them on his hips and then bump your hips up. And that'll be what it motivates him to get off, because, you know, at that point you're taking away his power, you're trying to escape, blah, blah, blah. And I had a moment where I explained to him, like, you know, the principles behind it. It honestly didn't matter. It was just choreography. But he got it right away. And like the truth is, yeah, like if someone's on mount and they're trying to punch at you and you just try to block all the punches, it's just gonna mean they're gonna punch you until you're unconscious. You know, you really can't sit there and just defend from the underneath the mount. You have to get out of there. You know, you got to escape. And so like that real world aspect of like, yeah, frame off, hit bump, start to shrimp away. Then him having to, it's a counter game. It's, you know, it's chess. Tyler Rake, of course, has to spin over, get into side control, flatten him back down. Then he goes to neon belly so we can start trying to punch him again. That's all in my mind, like very, you could just see that happen in an actual cage fight. You could see that happen in an actual jiu-jitsu match. I guess not with the pounding, but, you know, it's that is like a ground and pound sequence that I could have literally even just subconsciously copied from some other like real fight that I'd seen, you know. That's yeah, I hope that in that regard it still comes off as like, I always talk about the cultural mindset and where we stand with fight choreography. You have to kind of choreograph knowing your audience. Even if I might be a brown belt in jiu-jitsu, if the audience isn't ready to see some of that stuff yet because they have no idea, it just looks weird to them, you know. There was a time in which people, you know, didn't know what a triangle choke was. It just looked weird to them. Why is that guy got his legs around? If you look at like Lethal Weapon back in the day, there's, you know, that's super cool to me that, you know, that Mel Gibson's putting Gary Busey in a triangle choke. But I don't think a lot of other people understood what was happening back then, besides maybe like the few guys who went to the Torrance Gracie Academy. You know, most people were probably like, I don't know what's happening. It's just weird. He's just like got his legs around his head. You know, and I said that about gun work too. There's a point at which we started understanding that like, if someone puts a gun, like ejects the mag from like a gun, right, and puts it down, that's not a sign that you should trust them. There's still one in the chamber. You got to rack that round out of the chamber. And there's like a whole bunch of movies where they don't do that. And it was a certain time in history where American audiences, or I'm sorry, not American audiences, just film audiences in general, started seeing the logic thread and saying like, wait a minute, he's still got a bullet in there. You shouldn't trust him now. It's like, all right, I guess we got to rack that bullet out so that way it makes sense. And now audiences, if they don't see you do that, they'll call you out on it. You know, something like Extraction's jujitsu content, I'm sure there's a lot of people that have no idea what's happening in it. And that was just like it was a bit of a litmus test for me. And I just wanted to see what we could get away with. It's super cool that we had a director who is, you know, obviously it's like all the jujitsu moves in there. He knows them in and out. So he was willing to let me get away with that. He's like, yeah, put it in there. Like, you know, if like audiences will be educated from that, which I thought was like kind of a cool idea of, you know, these movies sort of inform the pop culture as far as like combat and martial arts, what we think is and is not possible. And like, if you show them some real world jujitsu application, like, you know, maybe they'll actually be interested enough to go look it up and see that, you know, this is something that really works, or like, this is how you should actually use this technique or what have you, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I could totally see someone on YouTube going in, clipping out a portion of this film, and then going through, breaking it down, looking at the angles, the level changes, and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's literally like in the first fight scene, Rake gets tackled by a stuntman named Dan Carter. It's the guy that gets the rake in the face at the end of it. I love that bit. But it's like, you know, he does a real world. I was like, all right. So he's, and I even described it in the room. We were doing it in like the hotel room the night before, trying to figure out how to do this extra sequence that we're going to add in. I was like, okay. So he's like, I'm in the bottom of side control. All right, I'm going to put my hand here. I'm going to do this thing. It's called the ghost. the ghost will put me into an escape position where I'm now on the top. He's like on all fours, and I'll lock this anaconda choke. This is all a bunch of like jujitsu babble right now. But yeah, and then it's like that sets us up for the gator roll, which will get us over to the rake. And then he can go to his side ride and use that in order to like push his head, you know, and that's all like, I mean, in theory, yeah, that's all totally legitimate. You know, I could probably see someone doing that in competition. You know, I'm sure you could just go on like submissions 101 and like see that exact chain of events happening like in a tutorial. But yeah, I'm hoping that someone does like get the chance to look at that and be like, are those real? And be like, oh my gosh, like you sort of in theory totally could do that. Like those are actual real techniques that some jujitsu nerd put into his movies, fight scenes.
The anaconda roll definitely stood out to me. That was great. And seeing some of the 10th planet jujitsu influence was fantastic too.
So much fun. I love that stuff. I mean, I'm a martial arts nerd myself. So if I see something like that, I just go nuts. Yeah, I go bonkers. I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
So is this something that is always in your head, even when you're training and learning actual like practical applications? Are you always thinking, oh, this would look great in a fight scene if this happened or if there were weapons involved and stuff like that? Is it something that's always in the back of your head?
Yeah, definitely. So that I think that kind of like links into this other point that a lot of people have asked me like in the past few weeks, which is, you know, I get a lot of people saying, if I wanted to start choreographing some fights, like, you know, what martial arts should I do? You know, like, what should I train? And, you know, and I'm honestly, like, one of the things that I'll say is like, well, the martial art that we do in all the films is just, it's Hollywood foo. You know what I mean? It's not real. Mm-hmm. And that to me just means that you can pretty much turn anything into something that looks like action, right? Like you can take something like, I mean, like a lot of people saw this fight, the fights in this movie is having a lot of Krav Maga. And, you know, that's awesome because that means that it speaks to them. Even if it wasn't in my head when I was doing something like that, it just shows that there's enough of a linking chain that anything can sort of be built into a fight scene and be justifiable with the given context. You know, like you can make everything work. So like for me, if I'm training a martial art, a lot of the times what I'm doing is just looking at, you know, oh, this would be kind of cool, but what if this happened? What if that happened? You know, I've done a lot of different like martial arts in the past and continue to do a bunch of them. And I always love being a jack of all trades, master of none, which is, maybe just like a joker of all trades, like master of none. Cause I don't think I'm that great at a lot of these martial arts. I think I'm like, okay, but everyone in my gym is like, I'm like one of the mediocre people in every gym that I go to. I have a lot of people that I can look to all the time. And so, you know, taking something like capoeira, which I did for like, you know, almost 3 years, that was like a cool little journey where I could sit there and say, all right, this is a martial art that I don't even know if I'm going to use. I don't think I'd ever use it practically. I don't know if I'd use any of my martial arts that practically in general, but the principles of it and the way of it moving, it's like, hey, look, we all saw Eddie Gordo in Tekken. We all saw Only the Strong. You know, it's like we've all seen like Latif Crowder in The Protector. It's like, it's got such cool stuff in it. There's such ripe, like there's a whole martial art that you can just mine cool things from and use in a creative aspect. Absolutely. Like if I'm training something, I want to know how it can be used to help tell a story and be used in like choreography or you know, whatever. And as much as like we love to kind of hone our own martial applications and, you know, be good, strong martial artists, like I have not been in a whole lot of fights in my life where I've had to, you know, use those things. You know, I'm not a professional fighter, not like even an amateur fighter, you know, and I'm not like someone that goes around trying to pick fights in on the street, you know, if anything, like I'm the guy that will be like, I, even if I have like a knife and a, like a baton or something in my car, if someone starts like talking smack to me, I'm the first guy to be like, hey, calm down, man. Like, look, let's sit down. Let's talk about this. Can I buy you like a coffee or something? You know, like, hey, you seem really upset, you know, and try to keep that rage in myself from like boiling up to a point where I go nuts. You know, I think we've all had like moments where I've hit a lot of people really hard in sparring before and even like, you know, outside of a martial arts context, just like in the regular world in the street and stuff, and like done real damage to people, like where, you know, it feels really great in the moment. And then within a few seconds afterwards, I feel incredible regret, you know? So I'm not a guy who thinks about how to best violently do things to people in the regular world without like sort of a moral sense of guilt coming along with it. So for me, the best cool part of like, well, yeah, if you do this movie, you can totally break someone's spine. I'm like, that would be cool in a movie. Like my mind just immediately goes to like a fictional setting in which that stuff can actually be justified and make sense. Because the real world alternative is something I don't really want to be a part of, you know, if that makes any sense, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. A true martial artist.
Hopefully. I mean, hopefully. I hope all of the people that I look up to as martial artists have that mentality. And so, you know, I would hope that I'm just respecting what they've taught me, you know.
And speaking of consequences from violence and things like that, it seems like Rake throughout the film really takes a bunch of damage and carries it with him throughout the film. Can you speak to that a little bit and how that affected the choreography as well?
Yeah, it ends up being an opportunity in a lot of ways. Like, for instance, when he's fighting Gaspar, the fact that Gaspar has an easy time, like, fighting him, like, I think he uses his sling to choke him at one point in time, which I thought was so much fun. I was like, oh, he'll do a collar choke, but he'll use the sling to get it. And I was like, yeah, sick. And then he punches him in the arm a few times. It can be a limitation, but I've always said that limitations can be your best source of creativity sometimes. There was a section that we ended up doing that didn't get, we did a lot of concepts for it, but it ended up being a moot point because it just didn't fit with the story at the moment. It was going to become way too much action and it needed to be more about the emotion of the moment. But at the end, when the chopper is about to, you know, the chopper's landed and he's trying to tell the kid, run to the end of the bridge, like run to the chopper. And then he goes to go the opposite direction to fight off the last wave of guys. There's a whole part where we originally had him taking a lot of hits during that. And then he was, I think he was like, his arm was going to not function. So he had to do a bunch of like one arm reloads and stuff like with his primary, then his secondary. And there were a lot of cool things that came out of it that are in my backlog for later if I need to use them. But, you know, it ended up being a moot point. But in that moment, we were forced to create some really interesting stuff with how is he going to do the sequence with one arm available to him. And, you know, because of that limitation, we have some really cool concepts, you know, now that it kind of came out of it. Like, if I think Charles Schulz, it's the guy that made Roadrunner, the old cartoon guy. There's a whole thing you can look up online about the Roadrunner rules, which is like all these specifically set rules that he has for how to write like a scene for Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. And at first you think like there's all these limitations, but in reality, what they do is they funnel your choices down to this way in which you have to make very concerted, very, very intelligent decisions about your creative work. I would say that like sometimes the best things that I've worked on as far as creativity have come from when we had no budget, you know, like you don't get the chance to like just answer it with, we'll fix it in post or we'll do it with computers or we'll, you know, like, oh, just trick it out, do it this way or use this big wire gag to take care of that. You know, you got to kind of figure it out in a lot of shorthand ways, which is super fun. It makes you much more creative, I think, in the end result. The fact that he takes a lot of damage throughout the movie, that would happen, you know, and so if you're trying to balance that all around the fight choreography, then good. That means you're on the right track, you know. Don't ignore that stuff. Always lean into those aspects of the story and embrace those limitations because those will always make you more creative than you think.
Right. Having coordinated all these fights for the movie, do you actually have a favorite kill from Extraction?
Oh, man. Oh, God, there's so many. They're so crazy. God, you know, if I'm thinking about it, there's one that always just gets me. That's really, really funny to me.
Yeah.
And this is stupid. This is probably not that interesting to a lot of people. I'll give you two. And for very weird behind.
Okay.
The one that I honestly point to first is when it's in the water, when the cops are combing the building, he does a long sequence and then the kid gets separated from him and runs through a tailor shop. So in the shop, that's actually me. And then there's another guy who, my good friend Anthony, who plays that same guard before they enter that shop. And then after he comes out of that shop, because we had to like juggle people around. It was like, you know, it's kind of a tough thing. People weren't necessarily available all at the same time that, you know, it's like on a movie like that, you're sometimes shooting more than two sets and things, two locations. There's a lot of stuff happening simultaneously. And I ended up having to play that guy for that run through the tailor shop. What I love about that sequence is that the one guy that survives that initial crazy onslaught, because he gets that character, if you watch it all the way back, when Tyler Rake goes off the chain and is tying up guys' arms and shooting all these people, the guy that ends up chasing through the tailor shop, the kid, that guy comes out and just gets muzzle punched in the face once, like with the pistol, and he drops. And he gets up and then chases the kid a little bit later on. He survives so much of that fight, goes through the tailor shop, is like eating like big boxes to the face and stuff, like dragging him around. He's just having like it's almost like a slapstick routine, like how awful his life is in that moment as the guard. And he, like, to the point where he's like swearing at the kid as he's walking out the door. He's like not even running. He's just like walking like, you little jerk. I'm like, And then he walks out the door and then immediately just shot to the head and falls. And it's like over the blink of an eye, like where it's just so much trouble and then just dead. And every time that happens, I just, yeah. I howl. I roll on the floor laughing about it because I think it's just so funny that you could build that up and then just blob. He's just dead. The other one is actually in the very beginning of the movie where we see the it does that Emma Diarrez thing where it shows the end of the movie and then goes back to the beginning. But in the very beginning scene, he shoots a guy up against a truck and that guy sort of like just slumps and falls. It's a very specific shot, but there's a shot online. You can find the stuntman, Travis Gomez,
who's Travis.
Yeah, right. He was one of our core guys. That's him that's getting shot up against the truck. And on that day, that was the same day that I got shot from the sniper and fell onto the ground. And there was this talk about like, oh man, did you guys see like, you know, like who hit the ground hardest? And they showed Travis's like behind this. You don't see it in the film because it's it doesn't show him hit the floor. But if you see the behind the scenes footage of him dropping to the ground, he basically just face plant. Like he slumps down and just headbutts the ground as hard as he can, it looks like. That's like my favorite hidden kill in it because you don't see how crazy of a wreck that was until you go to Instagram and you look up Travis's page and you're like, oh my God, his head. How did you get that? Yeah. You look like you got concussed. It's so hard. And on that day, they were like, who hit the ground harder? It was like Mike or Travis. And I maintain to this day, I'm like, I don't know what you're looking at. Travis 100% hit the ground harder than me. That was a gnarly face plant.
Wow. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being on this podcast. Honestly, a pleasure to have you. We actually want to end it off on one last question. Having such a big fascination with watches, what is the most underrated watch? What is the most underrated watch that you own? And will getting a watch actually make me better at fighting?
Oh my God. I'll say it. The most underrated watch that I own, I want to say, is my Nomos Glashütte world timer. It's not really a world timer. I don't know what they call it that, but it sort of is. It's from a brand that's relatively young. You know, they came around, like I believe, in the 90s or something, or like early 2000s. Nomos, who's like a German watch company, very, very good artisan like work, very cool like Bauhaus modernist sort of designs. Like if you like that simplistic, if you look at something like an Instagram watch brand like a Daniel Wellington or something, Nomos would be like, if you like that style, like the Bauhaus style, like Nomos is like sort of the modern king of it in my opinion, and very, very underrated. I think they're outstanding and no one knows who they are except for like watch nerds. Wow. Like people on the street would be all like, I don't even know what that is. Someone, when I told someone that I bought it, they got mad at me for buying it. They're like, why didn't you just get a Rolex or something? And I was like,
no way.
I don't think you understand what I'm in this for, but you know, I think they're just gorgeous. They're all very, very like, they seem to be like very nice people and everything. Yeah. I just think they're fantastic. As far as, if it makes someone better at fight choreography, I would hazard a guess to say that no, it does not. If you wear it and you look at it and feel inspired, then that's your whole thing. But I would say that the best fight choreography just comes from being a creative artisan of violence and, you know, just having a passion for it more so than anything else. I think there's no substitute for someone just having the passion.
Right. Of course. I'll definitely have to check it out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I hope you fall in love with them like I do.
Well, I know Mike actually has one last question. We probably will add it in here as a bonus if we have time. Mike?
Yeah, totally. So I know you did a little work with Rocket Jump on something called Jess's Big Short. Those are some personal heroes of mine. Those are the videos that really got me to
learn
action and action comedy. Can you tell me about how that experience was?
Yeah. I hope I'm not going over too long with this, but I can attest to, I actually got introduced to those guys. I met Clinton on when he was Punisher back in the day. When he did a video, we were talking about Sleeping Dogs earlier. We did a live action Sleeping Dogs video with a stunt team called the EMC Monkeys. And I'd been friends with EMC for a long time. They, you know, they taught me a lot of stuff, especially about like fight choreography and camera work. And then when they got the job from Clinton, you know, we did that job. And that was sort of my introduction to those guys, like the corridor team that, you know, I met Freddie there. And, you know, like one of the days after we shot, I was really stoked because obviously, you know, I was watching them back in like the whole Rocket Jump days of like, you know, cardboard warfare and stuff like that too, with like Punisher's channel. Like, so many cool things. And that blew my mind that you could do so much VFX. That was one of the first things that I noticed, like that the world of filming had changed, right? That big budget VFX were being done by these very indie YouTube guys is a huge game changer. And I don't know if everyone gave them as much credit as they should have back in the day. I think everyone knows them now as being amazing, but back in the day, I was like, guys, they're going to be huge. Like, they're going to be this massive thing. So obviously, like, those guys who made Rocket Jump and everything like that, I got that job through my friend, Emmanuel Manzanares, had pulled me in on it. And that is one of the most fun experiences I've ever had. I do a dead man in that, which is a wire gag where, I don't know if you guys are aware, they basically tie you, you put on your wire harness, they attach a wire to you, a line, and then they tie it off to something that does not move, like a girder or something. And then you basically run until the line hits its snapping point, and then it just sucks you back down. Like, it's just like running into a wall, but backwards. So, and that gag, like, I had to run and then jump on a mini trampoline and then like turn into it, because it's supposed to look like she's throwing me across the room, and then I get shotgunned, and the shotgun is what, you know, supposed to stop me and send me to the floor. And that gag was this gigantic thing where I remember doing it, testing it a bunch of times, being like, yeah, that's cool, I think it feels fine. And then I couldn't check my blind spot on the way home, because I'm like, I think my spine is messed up. Like, I think I overdid it. It's just your muscles just take such a huge shock from that immense whip of like rotating that quick. And I say this like as if it's like this badass thing. Every single dead man I've ever seen anyone else do from any of my friends, they've all been gnarlier than mine. I think I had like the easiest dead man, and I just complain about it a lot. But on the day when we went to go shoot that, there was no, I hope I can say this, but they didn't really have a nice anchoring point that was secure enough to get the right angle. Like the stage, the set that they built was just not set up to accommodate that wire gag as smoothly as it could have been done. So we ended up having, we actually had like a heavy bag, like a heavy, like a kickboxing bag in one of the stunt guys' trucks. And we put that down on the floor and had three of our stuntmen sit on it. And we just tested it. I was like, I think it's going to stay still. I don't think I can move those guys. Even if I run and jump as hard as I can, it's not going to move. And so that's how we simulated that that shot of the dead man. It's just three dudes just sitting on a heavy bag, and I'm attached by a wire to the heavy bag. And like as I'm getting ready to take off and jump onto the mini tramp, I'm like looking at them, and I have to run past them. It's like a weird, like a runway or something, like a walkway, or you're going past all these. Yeah. And we're all just like looking at each other like, this is the craziest way we've ever solved this problem, I think. Like, I don't know if we've ever done this before. After that, all of us were like, because it obviously worked, you know, it made the show. We were like, I can't believe that worked. Can we all remember that this is a good substitute? Like, if we ever need it, like if you ever just caught in that situation, maybe we can do it again. Like, I'm pretty sure we would all plan much better at this point in time now, or like we would just make sure that it happened differently. But, you know, at the time, that was such a cool way of getting through it. And it's just always a good testament to how people like, you know, and then obviously like the like Clinton and them, they're like, well, yeah, we can just paint that out and stuff like in the day. You know, if you need to, you can always collaborate with the other filmmakers and the other stunt guys on set to make sure that you get the shot done right, get it done safe, and then still give a really cool result. And for me, that's always been the cool thing about filmmaking and about, you know, just being in this industry, especially with stunts, is that it's like a whole bunch of people who are doing what looks like wacky and crazy stuff, but really it's just, you know, it's just daring because everyone's they're calculating their risks and they're trying to mitigate that danger factor, you know, so that way it can be done safely. And at the same time, it's still a girl throwing a guy across a room into a shotgun blast that makes him stop dead in midair. Man, this is like so much fun. Like, who else gets to do that as part of their day job? You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm a big fan of those guys because they carry that indie spirit along, and that's what got me into this whole industry, was, you know, making weird little shorts like that. And to see that those people can have that kind of success is, man, it warms my heart, because, you know, I've seen those guys go from back in the Sleeping Dogs days and just being YouTube phenomenons to having TV shows, you know, and like being legitimate, recognized filmmakers across the world is, you know, that's what you hope. You just hope for success for all the people that, you know, that you respect.
Definitely, man. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast again. We hope to probably have you back a second time, actually, because there's so much stuff that we didn't even get a chance to cover, but it's crazy, actually. But
I tend to ramble on, so that's almost definitely my fault, so I apologize for that.
No, we loved it. Thank you so much. But yeah, we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it too. Thank you so much. This is so much fun. And yeah, I love that you guys have such a passion for it. And anytime you guys want to chat again, I'll be available.
Amazing. All right. See you, Michael.
Hell yeah. Thank you, brother.